Jo Wright, and this is the Coaching Culture Podcast, where we discuss how to make work better. Hello, and welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast. My name's Jo Wright, and today I'm joined by the fabulous David Liddle. David, welcome to today.
Oh, thank you, Jo. Thanks so much for having me. Really looking forward to it.
Oh, thank you. And David, you're the founder of the TCM Group, and you're with us today because you have so much interest and passion, and an acclaimed author of some fabulous books, of which one of them I have here, which is Transformational Culture. And for the guests who come onto the show and also who listen to us, the listeners, we are all interested in understanding about culture. So the book was shortlisted as Business Book of the Year 2021, which is absolutely fantastic. And it is a great book, and every organization should have one of these in their hands. So David, welcome to today.
Oh, thank you, Jo.
And in terms of, so people will be interested in listening to about you and your story. So if you could share a little bit of what's got you into writing books about transformational culture.
It's a long story, Jo, so I'll keep it short. So I've been involved in the area of conflict resolution for 30 years. Prior to that, I did a degree in race community relations. So I was really interested in racism, anti-racism, discrimination, inclusion and exclusion, and the sort of theories behind it, as well as sort of building up my awareness of those issues. So I did my degree, and then I went to work in the wonderful city of Leicester. And I worked in the area of economic regeneration and community cohesion before I then went to set up a charity, one of the first charities in the UK, providing mediation and restorative justice services in local community disputes. So think neighbours at war, think loud noise, think loud barbecues, people doing really rather unpleasant things to each other, I'm afraid to report, Jo. But I brought mediation into those scenarios, bringing residents and communities together. I started to work in gang disputes, and then got involved in serious crimes, knife, gun crimes, and then started to work in more serious cases, including murder and unlawful killing, and bringing people together using principles of restorative justice, mediation, nonviolent communication. So I ran the charity for 7 years or so, and I went to De Montfort University to do an MBA to sort of understand a little bit more about how organisations worked. Yeah. Because I was invited by the Cabinet Office to go into the Cabinet Office and bring some of these principles into the UK government. And I'm really proud to be working across the civil service to develop these principles across the civil service. So this was around 1990, the early noughties. And I did my MBA, which I've got a distinction in, studying the use of restorative justice within the Cabinet Office and also within two large London boroughs I was working with, Croydon and Hounslow. And that's where it all began. I was sat in the back of my MBA class, Jo, and I was kind of learning about Japanese management systems, TQM, Kaizen, quality circles, continuous improvement, Ishikawa, all of those kind of things. And then I was looking to Harvard and Cornell around integrated conflict management systems. And I put integrated conflict management systems, which was whole systemic changes to attitudes to conflict, and TQM, Japanese systems, and came up with total conflict management. That softened down to TCM, or the TCM group, but it started off. And then for the last, I suppose the beginning of my career in setting up my consultancy, the TCM group, which was one of the best things I've ever done, was very much I was a mediator, and I had a team of mediators, and like many organizations, were very reactive, very conflict averse, didn't deal with it in the moment, close to source. They waited for it to get really bad, Joe, and waited for it almost to get on the steps of the tribunal, grievances and people off sick and people distressed and harmed. Then they call in a mediator and say, come in and try and fix this. And you'd look at it and you'd take a deep breath, steel yourself and walk into these kind of these war zones that were created in our offices and depots and boardrooms. And it worked. I mean, what was really powerful and really incredible to me was actually, people were desperate for dialogue. They were desperate for to be heard, to rebuild trust and communication. And mediation played a really powerful part in that, albeit it was often behind closed doors and at the end. And I thought, hang on, there's too much here. This is too powerful. Yeah. It's too much. There's too much going on here for it to be behind closed doors and to be kind of only brought in as a sticking plaster. And you don't have to look up into many organisations' systems and go, what are you doing to your people? And why are you doing this to your people in this way? And it's so harrowing. And why are organisations, and I use this term deliberately? Why are we choosing to be retributive and adversarial and confrontational in our organizations when we could choose another route, which is about promotion of dialogue? So my life's work since then, certainly over the last 10 years, has been moving into looking at our HR systems, grievance and discipline. Don't get me started, Joan. On the corrosive and pernicious state of our HR systems, you know, looking at our leadership and management attitudes to conflict, change and culture, and of course our organizational cultures. And you know, speeding now, fast forward to present day, I wrote a book in 2017, you mentioned Managing Conflict, which was a real challenge, a provocation to organizations to do this stuff better. And transformational culture was my message to organizations, which is we can shift the dial on our cultures to be more purpose-driven, more values-based, more person-centric, and be higher performing and more productive. We can't, it's not a dichotomy. Being nice to people, being kind, compassionate, does not equal not achieving high performance and achieving value and profit. So that's the principle in my book. You can have your cake and eat it when it comes to work culture.
Absolutely, you can. And you are so, so right. I often say, build a culture of trust and high performance will follow. It's not the other way around. So don't aim for high performance and then go grabbling around for building trust. Go there first and guess what follows. It's surprising that, isn't it? That actually, how at last organisations are definitely waking up to how important culture is and actually how being people-centred is going to make all the difference, and actually caring for people and then you can have healthier conflict. When you do disagree, it's coming from a positive place. It's coming from a place where you've already got trust. And then the great results follow, and that's it, isn't it? It's
simply put. You've put it so simply, and it amazes me how something which is so simple, organisations can get so very, very wrong. But as you rightly said, so many organisations, Joe, are waking up to the opportunities and the possibilities from dialogue, of cooperation, collaboration, building trust. And of course, when trust goes, so too does communication. So too does empathy, so does common sense. So as you're building trust, as you rightly said, which becomes the seed within our organizations, which when we water it and nurture it grows, it builds communication, it builds trust, understanding and insight, it underpins innovation, productivity. And actually, and I find this really fascinating, when we handle difficult situations at work, whether they're conflicts and disagreements, which we've been so fearful of, not only does it help to resolve the issue, i.e. brings the parties together and they're less quarrelsome and less dogmatic, actually unlocks this incredible innovation and creativity, not just about how do I fix my relationship with you, but what's the systemic and structural, institutional and cultural factors that were causing our differences and our disagreements, and how could we better resolve those? So as managers who are wanting to get culture right, actually embracing and engaging with conflict positively and constructively is unlocking innovation and creativity in a way that almost no other thing in our organizations can unlock. If you want to find out how to run your organization better, go and ask the two quarreling people in your team. They'll tell you how to run your organization better. Don't run from them. Go and embrace them.
Go and lean into it. So that feels
lean into
like,
it.
Yeah, lean into it. That feels like a really great piece of advice. So if you're wanting to know how to run your organization and successfully, don't avoid conflict. Go lean into it and figure out how to then, I suppose, unlock that creativity, resolve the conflict, but in a creative way, I guess, and then it will all, the performance will grow on the back of it. I'm trusting that that's what you're meaning there, isn't it? Kind of the performance follows.
It is.
Yeah. So talk to me about that. The organization, so you've been working with organizations for many years in terms of transformational culture. So you've talked about, you have in your book, you talk about toxic cultures and then you've got your transformational. What are the experiences on those two extremes? Because, you know, transformational culture feels like a really interesting from and to position, whereas toxic is over here, but a hugely successful culture is over there. Tell me your experience of examples of those, because I think they'd be really interesting.
No, of course. I've worked with so many teams, whether it's in healthcare, in private sector, in universities and in colleges, where those teams, departments, divisions, the communication's broken down, as you alluded to earlier, trust breaks down, that mutual respect breaks down, and those teams go into what I call culture shock. And we start to see a real impairment to individuals' psychological and physical well-being. The relationships become damaged and tarnished. And having worked with a great many of those teams and departments, I've seen also the power of listening, of understanding, of creating a shared sense of our underlying needs and goals rather than the rigid, strong positions that we've adopted. So I've seen the power of that so many times within broken, dysfunctional, damaged teams, teams experiencing distress in so many different ways. I suppose the culture, the opposite of that in terms of transformational culture, is looking at the systems in our organization. So we'll just give one example, Joe. So I often talk to people about many F words, and don't worry, I'm not talking about the kind of F words we might be thinking about. I'm talking about failure, feelings, fear, fights. I've seen there's a lot of F words. And I look at those F words within our organizations, and we run from those. We're scared of those. We've designed systems and processes to mitigate and manage almost every F word in our organization. But what we haven't designed in our organizations is the ability to embrace, to understand, to learn, and to listen. So transformational culture, and of course those systems, Joe, are intrinsically retributive. So we've developed systems and processes, which is if it goes wrong, we want to find out who's at fault. Yes. If someone's feeling in a particular way, well, we'll probably avoid dealing with it. And when we can't avoid dealing with it anymore, we'll engage in expensive overreaction and we'll overreact to these situations. This fear that permeates through our organizations, are we giving our managers and leaders the skills they need to handle these issues and create psychological safety? So for me, the transformational culture removes those retributive, adversarial, confrontational elements of our organizations and builds instead more restorative approaches using coaching, mediation, restorative practices, taking out those, going back to my views on discipline and grievance procedures, they are the antithesis of everything that is good about humanity and human beings. They are vicious, damaging, destructive policies that play no part in our modern workplace. Yeah, I hear HR and people, professionals and others espousing their compassion, espousing being great places to work. Yet when the face doesn't fit, the performance drops, they get into a quarrel, we drag them to hell and back, destroying their lives and destroying their relationships. So one of the key features of a transformational culture is an adjustment of our justice model from retributive justice to transformative justice, delivering natural justice, still delivering procedural justice, but with a heavy focus on restorative rather than retributive justice. So permeating them through our HR systems, through our leadership and management behaviors, through the entire jargon alert, employee value proposition and customer value proposition. So to me, culture shift and transformational culture is talking about something I just don't think we talk about enough in our workplaces, which is the concept and principles of justice and how we can move away from these retributive and corrosive justice systems which permeate through our organizations. You just have to look at the employee handbooks in most organizations, Joe, written by barristers, and it's all about you're this and you're that, and I'm going to do this to you when you're naughty and da da da. So, my goodness gracious me, what a damaging and harmful way to welcome a new employee in this highly litigation-inspired system that we're seeing. So many organizations are rejecting that. Not enough in my books, but so many organizations now are rejecting that in favor of something more human and humane.
Absolutely. And, I was recently reading, which I absolutely love, I think it's HubSpot, I've got their one policy in the organization is use good judgment. You know, I think they've assumed that they've got adults in the workplace who are wanting to think and behave like adults, so use good judgment. And then there's other organizations who, you know, their only policy is, if it's in the interest of the business, and make a good judgment then. So as long as you're not doing anything that doesn't feel right for the business, then do it. You're an adult, that's what you're there for. And that is their policy. And I just love that. Whereas I think, you're right, we can get absolutely hung up on, like you called it, retributive, the policies to kind of make sure people know when they put their foot wrong, what's going to happen to them, as opposed to embracing humanity and that human, you know, we talk about it a lot now, don't we, in terms of be more human, human-centered leadership, all the great things that people are really recognizing now. I think a lot more organizations are, and I know they've still got a long way to go, but I know the pandemic's definitely triggered some more of that. But it, you know, we've been on this journey for a while, and I think people are, organizations are waking up, which is wonderful, but maybe not quick enough. And there's probably some work to do in HR there as well to really unlock this. But also at the whole top table, I always think it's never just the role of HR. It's the business who you know, needs to work on the culture. But have you got examples of whether you want to name them, but examples where you've seen real transformation, you know, when you've gone in there and worked, you know, what have you seen happen where, you know, an organization's gone from A to possibly Z, Z,
Z. Lots of great. I'll just go back to the policy. You know, I could write your employee handbook in three simple sentences: do no harm, follow our values, be the most brilliant version of yourself.
Love it.
And if we could do that, and if we can create this space where we can do that, and of course, sometimes we need help, Joe.
Yeah.
Sometimes we can do it ourselves, but other times we need help. And if our people professionals could deploy wisdom, if they could deploy coaching skills, mentoring skills, if they could act as mediators and facilitators to promote dialogue and position themselves in that role of creating those cultural norms that we're describing, so too does the people profession become the most strategically important function in the organization, because that people profession now is creating those cultural norms by creating alignment that underpins, as we said at the start of the podcast, underpins productivity. And who isn't right now trying to address productivity and performance issues in our organizations? How do we do that? By creating these cultures. And who's doing this? I mean, we're doing some great work with Burberry. Just fantastic work. And they've been rethinking and rewriting so many of their organization policies, processes, and systems globally. We just were up for an award with Aviva with some of the work we've been doing with Anthony Fitzpatrick and these colleagues within Aviva to promote a whole new set of cultural norms within Aviva. There's no grievance procedure in Aviva, Joe.
No.
This is about promoting dialogue and encouraging colleagues to come together. We're up for a Personnel Today Award last year with, we won, actually, not just up for it, we won with TSB Bank. The Change Management Award is TSB. We're developing and adopting a really powerful focus on transformation and transformational culture. And I was very grateful that TSB have written a case study for transformational culture. We've worked with police forces up and down the country. And in fact, we're working with a police force over in Canada at the moment to help develop this. Bloomberg over in the States have adopted much of this stuff, and we've been working closely to develop capacity in there. And we're working all over the world, really, with organizations who share our values and principles and are starting to see this now as a really important step towards a culture which I think many would accept is going to help to attract the top talent.
Yeah.
It's going to help to attract the customers. And we talked before the podcast about the importance of customers and retaining customers and customers coming back to us. Well, why do customers come back? Yes, it's because you deliver a good service. Yes, it's because your price is right. But it's also because there's a cultural alignment between the customer and the organization. And of course, investors are now looking through the ESG agenda, but also focusing in on now organizational culture. And we see every day on our news feeds, coming out of our Alexas and all whatever the device of choice is, we see this stuff all the time of cultures breaking down and the harm of the turmoil and the harm on the reputation. So thinking about the reputational benefit, the benefit in terms of social value, stakeholder value, shareholder value, there's so much value to organizations to rethink their cultural norms. But we need to be courageous. We can't tinker around the edges and just put some nice messages onto Instagram and put a nice poster up in our lobby and have our values as a sort of nice, shiny statement that no one can really remember what they are, but they look nice on a website. That's not cultural change. Real cultural shift means when we're living those and they become a golden thread that runs through the entire organization, pulling us together with a sense of common purpose and common bond. So the organisation. We're very fortunate. We're working with some wonderful, wonderful organisations to help make this stuff happen.
Oh, it's just brilliant. It's brilliant to hear because, you know, it's about time, isn't it, that these shifts really started happening, and not just for us in the workplace now, but for the future, for, you know, kids are in school now, they're going to be in the workplace in X number of years. It's about getting it right. Absolutely. Now, isn't it? It's interesting you talk about values and those that, you know, people don't live and breathe every day. We've adopted at Coaching Culture something called culture codes rather than values. I did a presentation at our conference. It was called Why Every Organization Needs a Culture Deck, which is literally we identified what, because it's taken us a little while to figure out who we are, you know, as we grow, we know what we value in organizations and how can we kind of create our own organizational culture. And we've got culture codes, and they're kind of rather than words, like the odd word here and there, we've got little quirky sayings. So one of them is, and it's so people remember them. So we've got one, for example, we eat our own dog food. So as I explained that at the conference, that's not everybody coming into work and bringing their own kind of pedigree from it. It literally is, we use our coaching solutions. That's one. We have one that's don't microwave fish in the office, which is obviously we don't really want people to microwave fish in the office, but it's about thinking about your impact on other people. So it's little things like that. In fact, the post that I did yesterday was change is inevitable, except from a vending machine. So in other words, we're going to go through.
I saw that. Yeah.
It's one of our culture codes. So they're more memorable than values, that you instantly can resonate with what it stands for rather than, well, trust, passion, courage. That means different things to different people. So I think that's something quite interesting in terms of thinking about how organizations even move beyond values now, five values on the wall, or exactly as you were saying, how can you make it about principles of behavior?
Absolutely. And I think I love that culture code, and I love that bringing it to life, and I love that walking the talk. And I think for me, the most powerful expression of values, though, for me, is I could walk into an office and you can see and feel and hear and you touch the values happening. And to be able to get to that moment in time, we need certain things to happen within the organization. So the culture code, the principles, the values, they need to feed into our agreed behaviors. We need to understand what the behaviors are. What are they aligned? What behaviors do we want to see?
Yeah.
But what behaviors don't we want to see? The misaligned. And most organizations, the way they codify behaviors is a list in the gross misconduct. You will be fired if you do this and this. But actually, there's very little that says, actually, we want you to behave this way or not that way. Of course, what we have then is we have these aligned and misaligned behaviors. And in the middle is the gap. Let's call the gap action, or an opportunity for action. So we need our managers to be able to use nudge theory to nudge you from misaligned. We need them to be able to reward and celebrate and coach and nurture and flourish those positive behaviors. We need to be able to do negotiation to help those behaviors to shift. So to me, those values, that culture code, those principles, and they go by so many different names. To me, it's about how do we embed them and try them in the organization so they become a living part of our organizational experience, and they underpin everything that we do in as an organization, as employees, as colleagues, as managers and leaders. And we begin to really live that principle, live the code. So it becomes, I love the culture code. It's bringing it to life for people rather than just this another poster and another deck or another, you know, people are over this now, aren't they? We need to be a bit more sophisticated, I think, Jo.
We absolutely do. We absolutely do. And we did sort of looked into some research to say that, you know, there was research done by different kind of research bodies basically saying, you know, people are going, well, they're not my values. They're the organization ones. So I'm now instantly misaligned with the values. I'm a human being too. Or I don't even know what they are, or, you know, and it's just like, well, how they definitely have served their purpose in the, you know, in the kind of transitional eras of the workplace, but I think it's time to move on now. It's time to move on and kind of times are changing. We've got to change with them. So in terms of your transformational culture, you talk about the seven C's of transformational culture. Share with us a little bit more about the seven C's, because I love them. I love them, love them, what they are. But for the listeners here who haven't got your book in front of them like I have, talk about the seven C's because they all do knit together perfectly to get to transformational culture.
Well, the nice thing about our work in people is so many of those positive words start with a C. So trying to choose seven was challenging enough. And of course, coaching is probably one of the big ones. Exactly. So there's an eighth C. But the seventh C is really, the first one is around courage.
Yeah.
And that's the courage to speak up. It's the courage to listen.
Yeah.
And that's sometimes very courageous because we need to listen to understand, not listen to defend.
Yeah.
And then the courage to act. And I talked about actions earlier and some of the skills and models that we can use to support that action. How that can then create the second C of connection, that belongingness and togetherness. Now, that doesn't mean sometimes people think connections, we're all going to have a big hug and a kind of big group hug and it's all going to be rather lovely. It's not. It's how do we connect based on our difference and how do we value that difference between us and see that difference as a sign of strength that connects us. Doesn't just connect us, but also helps to create that 2+2=5 effect as we connect together and our difference becomes a source of strength.
Yeah.
Rather than the diversity becoming a source of adversity, as we say in so many organizations. Focusing on the third one, which is around collaboration, Joe, as a mediator and restorative practitioner, you knew I was going to say that, but it's collaboration. How can we collaborate, particularly during the good times, and how can we work together as a team, breaking down those silos and those kind of that functional mindset that we see in organizations where we can work across teams, we can work across functions, but particularly at times of conflict, crisis, and controversy. And haven't we got that going on in our world right now? Yeah. Don't we need people to be collaborating? Are we seeing them building walls when we desperately need them? We're screaming at our TVs, build bridges, don't build walls.
There
they are doing just that. And don't we wish that they wouldn't? And don't we wish they would collaborate? Going to your point around shared values and my values and alignment and those purpose, that building of common purpose and common ideas, something that brings us together, that culture code again, something that pulls us together where we are in alignment. To a single sense of a clear objective and a clear sense of purpose. That drives us, empowers us, and gives us a passion because it reflects my own sense of purpose and my own needs. And I was talking to a senior leader from an NHS trust today, and they're doing some fantastic work about helping people not just to express their purpose and how it aligns to the organization, but designing their entire working day. It was quite a fantastic achievement that they put in place in this organization. What hours are you wanting to work that fit around you? We'll work to you. What are your needs from the workplace? We'll start to design the workplace around you. So not just kind of finding a middle ground and a sort of nice compromise in terms of common purpose, but a real true sense of an alignment between the world of work and the future world of work and our people. So the next C then is communication. I think we've already talked about trust being a cause of the breakdown in communication. And when I think about communication, Joe, I don't just mean in terms of two people communicating, which clearly is important.
No.
I also think about the triumvirate of our HR professionals, unions, employees, managers and others communicating to build a strong, again, excuse the jargon, social contract within our organizations, as well as the strong psychological contract. The next C to me is probably one of the most important, which is compassion. Being kind does not mean being soft, fluffy, and just turning a blind eye to bad behavior. Being compassionate is the ability to put ourselves in another person's shoes, to understand what's going on for another person, to have deep personal awareness and of myself, and to be able to listen to myself and also to be able to listen to others, to validate and recognize the needs and goals of others and look for an alignment with myself. And that compassion can be incredibly powerful in creating the challenge conversations that we need within our organizations to be able to grow. And one final thing, there's another challenge there, is the last one's curiosity.
Yeah.
Go and give your people a jolly good listening to. Stop avoiding the conversation. Stop avoiding the conversation. They've got something they want to say to you. Go and listen to them. Because when they speak to you and you can break down that defensive, don't listen to defend yourself. You don't need to defend yourself.
No, I agree.
If you listen to them and let them speak, listen for meaning, then we can really engage with people. They'll tell us what's working, what's not working. Let's go and engage in a big listening exercise. So curiosity is the final of the seven C's. And perhaps if we put them all together, we'll have better workplaces, he says somewhat optimistically.
Well, I definitely think you've got the eights there, which is definitely that. To me, you've just absolutely describe what we call a coaching culture: conversation, the communication, the compassion, collaboration, all that builds trust, connection, curiosity, asking great questions, but listening to the... That's why we're speaking today, David, to be fair. I find the eight C's of a transformational culture. Our definition of a coaching culture is: a coaching culture is a place where authentic leaders and managers help people to grow, thrive and perform through effective conversations, honest feedback and underpinned by trust. And I think if I had a tattoo, that's what it would say on it somewhere, although that feels quite terrible. But it feels too long, but it's the same thing. We're all screaming out for the same thing here, aren't we, in what organisations are striving for now. And more organisations are getting there, and still some on the journey, but that definitely the same thing here, isn't it? Compassion, curiosity. And I love that phrase, give your people a jolly good listening to, which is awesome. Because that kind of makes me say jolly good telling off, but that's not what you're meaning. You're meaning the opposite.
A complete opposite. I love that. I love it. This is why I love what you're doing and the work you do at Coaching Culture. It's so powerful and it raises the profile of this. And so do I. But this, I think what you do so well, and I think it's trying to do myself in a small way, isn't so much about my desire for those things to operate within organisations. This is what people are screaming out for in their workplaces, in the depots, in the nursing teams, in the airports, wherever they are. This is what people are screaming out for. This is the nature of their lives. This is what they want from their workplaces. And it feels that organizations, I think you reflect this so beautifully in Coaching Culture, is a deep understanding of what it is that people need from the world of work. And to an extent, we're trying to both hold a mirror up to organizations to say, look what you're doing to your people, but then offering some powerful guidance to help them move away from it. And I'm really excited by that. And I think it's a really great opportunity. And I think that answers not just the how, and this is something I'm really passionate about. Isn't just the why do it? It's the how to do it. And I think coaching and the whole development of that coaching culture and that sort of transformationalism I talk about, it provides a guide for people. This is how you can do it. And do you know something? Don't be scared of it. It's nothing to be embarrassed about. Just go and have a go, and actually you'll help make people's working lives better, because that's what they want. That's what they're screaming out for. Let's listen to them and hear what they've got to say.
Absolutely. And I often think about, how people behave at home with their families and their friends who they love dearly. And then they go to work and it's like a different person's appeared. They lose that compassion. They lose that care. They lose that, the same care that you show to your family and friends. You know, why can't you show that to your colleagues as well? Because actually you'll have such a more productive, fruitful, positive relationship. It's all about relationships at the end of the day. And this is what, transformational culture is, I suppose, unlocking there. It's the relationships in organisations, in the whole system.
Well, it is, but it's a great point you've made, a really, really great point. Why do we leave that at the steps of the doors of our offices? It's because our organisations don't recognise its value, Joe. So if you look at the standard job design of most managers or the training programmes for most managers, I've been going into workshops and conferences and seminars for 30 years asking, why are we doing this to our people? And I'll always get the same response from someone in the audience. It's because we recruit our managers based on their technical skills and then put them into tough people management roles without giving them the skills. But you were saying that to me in 1990.
Yes,
it's 2020s.
Yeah.
Why are we still doing it? Can we not wake up and smell the conflict and recognize the impact of the culture and the shock that we're putting into people? So it's not difficult to say, okay, if we value compassion, if we value dialogue, if we value empathy, if we value the ability to negotiate based on our needs and goals, let's design it into our systems. Let's give our managers the skills they need. Let's design it into the job designs and the onboarding and the recruitment and the development pathways. Because if we're not doing that, and we know, and I think this is a really important point, if we know that the impact of this is great and measured in terms of the human cost, the financial cost, the organizational cost, we are in neglect by not giving our managers and people the skills that they need to manage. We are actively now in opposition to them doing the job they need to do. And it is an act of great neglect on the part of the people putting them in the job. This isn't a passive, oh, woe is me, we've got another manager who's not coping. They're not coping because you didn't give them the skills and tools they needed to be able to do the job effectively. You set them up to fail and now you're beating up on them. That's not good enough in a modern organisation.
Absolutely, flip it on its head. And it's when I hear managers as well talking about their teams, they'll say, oh, we don't need this, but my team does. And it's like, just that phrase in itself probably means you do. And I often say to leaders and managers, you know, if you're moaning about members of your team, look at yourself first. Before you look at them, think, what have I done to set them up for success? And if you think you've done everything, then that's brilliant. But I bet you haven't. And therefore, look at you first, then go and figure it out. Look at yourself. It's that mirror up, isn't it? That organisational mirror. You know, what have we done to support these people? I often say that being in a people leadership role or management role, it has to be seen as a privilege. And it has to be seen as a privilege because you are looking after and supporting people's lives. Their career is a massive part of their life. You are making a difference every day to their mental health. Whether you think you are or not, you are. And it's like, what are you doing? It's a privilege. So develop your people skills, your emotional intelligence, your empathy. Doesn't mean to say you're being soft. This will help you build trust and drive performance every single time. It's a fascinating topic. I think one day I would definitely love to do some more real studies into organisations, you know, in terms of the culture, and because so much potential is still out there, isn't there, to really make a difference. In terms of... What do you see as the key things that are getting in the way? What do you see when you're speaking to all these brilliant, it sounds like you're making great difference in the organisations, but what gets in the way of more organisations waking up to realising this is the answer?
Yeah, it's a great question, Jai. I think organisations have become, they've sleepwalked into a culture of risk mitigation and risk aversion. And as a result of that, they are dealing with the problems that are right in front of their face all the time and managing them as a risk. Yeah. So the absence of clear systems theory or clear system thinking, the ability to take a step back and look at the system in its whole.
Yeah.
Because we can't fix these complex problems by only turning one screw in the system. So my transformational culture model, which I offer as a blueprint, whilst on the face of it is quite complex and has quite a lot of different elements to it, it's as simple as I could make it, recognizing that the system itself is complex. So one of the things I would recommend, when I'm working with HR or people, professionals, leaders and others, is to take a step back and look at the whole situation as a system requiring systemic change. And what I mean by that is, yes, of course, the relationships in the organization are critical and a key feature of the system. But what are the processes and mechanisms around that? I've talked before about grievance and disciplinary, but there's also performance and other procedures. What's the leadership behavior and the leadership approach within the organization? Is it autocratic, command and control? Is it servant leadership? Is it transformational leadership? Is it incoherent and it's unclear? Is it just working in these volatile, uncertain, complex and ambiguous times? Is it just constantly fighting fire after fire? What support do we provide to our managers? What relationship do we have with our union? So to me, is taking a step back and look at this systemically and structurally, and then taking all of those wonderful principles that you were just describing and threading them through the system. I call it culture flow, drawing on the work of Martin Seligman and positive psychology and thinking about flow as an antecedent and driver of human happiness and purpose. Yep. You know, you can think about that Daniel Pink stuff, the mastery, autonomy, purpose, which is really important. And I know he's such a strong advocate of positive psychology. But we can also apply that positive psychology into the organization's systems. So we take a look at the system. Then we start to think about what do we need our systems to be able to do to deliver happier, healthier, more harmonious and higher performing organizations. So what are we trying to strive and achieve here? And then we can start to work backwards from that. And I think the critical feature then as well, and I see this, is there is so much tension in our organizations because of the competitive and siloed nature of our workplaces. So we're not having the right conversations at the right time. So we need HR to be having conversations with managers at the moment where there's an issue and a resolution. So coaching becomes an important part of the feature of those conversations. Of course it does. But it's also taking a step back and developing hubs or systems within our organizations whereby we can be predictive and proactive, using data to inform decision making. Organizations are sat, Joe, on so much information and data. And I think we only scratch at the surface under that, so drawing out that data. So I'm kind of going around in lots of different directions, but in essence, it's step back, look at the system, bring a coalition of people together to help to understand and analyze the system, and then start building flow within the system, which will be output what's going to be a happier, healthier, more harmonious environment for people to shine. That will then help to drive that productivity, which is the natural output and outcome. So those are just some of the features that we work with organizations to do and to do to great effect. And I would agree with you about the need for more evidence and data to support the outcome. And I'm working hard as part of my work to develop systems of evaluation and data to evidence everything that I'm just talking about now and provide good, solid evidence of its impact.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think we know it, we can feel it, and we can see it often. Yeah. But actually, I think you're right. Some organisations are definitely wanting that sort of real level of data, evidence. It's interesting because I think we were asked pre-pandemic a lot more about the ROI of coaching, and it used to make me go, it was really difficult to put that tangible. They wanted a tangible number, and it was like, and we'd talk about lots of different things. That question has gone away since the pandemic. That question for us, people are not asking us anymore about the ROI of coaching. Not never, but hardly ever. Because I think that, so much is being said, particularly on social media, in the news, the right level of thinking, like the books that you've written, more and more examples of this works, this is working. And actually, I know the ROI, it's there. It's there in the organizations who are succeeding. It's there when you start lifting under the bonnet of how are they doing that? It's all the things you're talking about here. It is. This is the secret to success.
I completely agree. I think it's a really important. You're making a really point. There's a part of me which thinks if we look at ROI as a measure of financial value in terms of shareholder wealth and shareholder value, then I think that measure is long gone. And I think it's important for the chief financial officer, but actually in the overall scheme of things, it's lower. But if you look at measure of the output of the organization now being, shareholder value, you can't ignore profit and ROI and profitability, but social value, which is critical, deploying, embracing social justice, employee activism, employee voice. And I think coaching plays a really important part. I think the biggest challenge, notwithstanding industrial relations disputes and tensions in our organizations, is employee voice and employee activism, Joe. I think we're saying to people, bring your whole self to work, but don't bring the bit that's concerned about misogyny and that bit that's out campaigning about racism. Just don't bring that little bit in. You know, that bit that's about challenging and speaking truth to power. Maybe you could forget that little bit as well. And people say, well, hang on. You just said bring the whole me to work. And now you're saying I can't do those bits. And I'm now confused. Is this what kind of work is this? So for me, I think where coaching and these conversations start to play a really important part, and I think we can start to measure the value, but measured not in ROI or shareholder value, but in terms of social value, social justice, stakeholder value, engagement, experience, customer experience, employee experience, all of those kind of measures are the financial metrics of boring old ROI. Then I think it is important we do start to look and measure more imaginatively the impact of our work in the modern world of work or in its contribution to the future of work. And I think that's a really important, exciting challenge that I enjoy is what's the value of the work measured in the terms I'm describing rather than the old classic, have you added a couple of extra quid onto the P&L? Well, maybe not.
Absolutely. I love that, the social value, and it's fascinating, and it's the whole great power shift, isn't it? There is definitely that shift happening. And I mean, obviously we're seeing that now, even in the UK right now, the employee voice in the strikes that are happening because these transformational culture has not been in place. So actually people are now voting with their feet. And that's something that I've never experienced in my lifetime to this extent. But actually the employee voice, and it goes back to you before, you said before, I still love that. Give your employees a jolly good listening to and then listen to and act upon what they're saying as well. Valuing the whole person at work, valuing their opinions. You know, I have a slide that I sort of churn out a lot, which is a from and to of culture. And the to bit is absolutely about that, you know, from tell to ask and, you know, people wanting their opinions valued and in the moment feedback. And people want to be part of something purposeful and meaningful. And they're part of that. It's not just a few people at the top of the organization anymore, you know, just barking down orders. It's the whole system that matter. And that's where the best ideas come from anyway, is everybody else, in my humble opinion.
I think it's more than a humble opinion. I think it's a well-described, eloquently put perspective on the world of work, Joe. And I think to me, you know, we talked earlier about leadership and what does it mean? And I think I see leadership. I had this conversation with a good friend of mine. We were talking about what does leadership mean? And I think it plays into a part of the conversation we had earlier. To me, true leadership is about bringing leadership out of others and enabling others to be leaders. And the problem I think we have in our world of work as it stands, and I think it's shifting, is because it's so competitive. If I release your inner brilliance and your inner leadership, you can compete with me in my leadership role. And because it's hierarchical and because power and authority and control are so clearly aligned to notions of leadership, I will feel threatened by doing so. And what I love about coaching culture, coaching conversations, and this whole shift towards this more a person-centered approach is actually, if I unleash your inner brilliance and your leadership, then I'm replicating that to great effect to help drive successful organizations going forward. So to me, a very simple definition of the leader is to unleash the inner brilliance of others and to create that leadership within others. And I think in so doing, it helps to address some of those points that you're talking to so clearly. And that's, to me, is I think one of the, to me, is a sort of, I'm a latecomer. I'm going to admit this, Joe. I'm a latecomer to coaching. I'm a mediator. Cut me in half, but no, please cut me in half, obviously. But you know, I'm a mediator through and through. I'm passionate about restorative practice and mediation, and I've always seen coaching as part of that. But I've very much been about bringing the parties together. And as I said, I'm a latecomer. Fairly recently, have I seen the true power of coaching? I see coaching as the, if you like, the filler that fills in the cracks in our cultures. It kind of comes in and fills the cracks, but it also provides the entire basis around which cultures can be created. I see that, to me, as I've sort of engaged with coaching as an approach and started to understand coaching perhaps in a more a deeper level, to me, I'm always going to say mediation's at the very top there, Joe, so you have to forgive me. But I'm going to say that coaching isn't far behind, and I'm loving learning about coaching. I'm loving seeing the power of coaching, and I'm loving seeing the impact it can have across organizations and teams and on a very personal level. So it's been I'm on a real learning mission, and coaching culture I take a lot of inspiration from, and the work you've been doing. It's part of that journey of discovery that I've been on.
Coaching and mediation feel, obviously the mediator being in the middle of two people who are possibly in conflict, for me coaching is the two people having the conversation themselves to unlock their conversation and communication, and through asking great questions, listening, building trust.
Yes.
So I wonder whether coaching, yeah, actually more coaching means less mediation. Maybe that's the challenge.
I love that. I think you're absolutely right. And I think you're absolutely right to put it the way you did. And to me, one of the downsides of mediation is you have to have a conflict. You know, there has to be some sort of discernible disagreement or a quarrel or fight in order for this wonderful thing called mediation to happen. And it's just so transformative and so powerful and so empowering. It's just the most incredible process that it unlocks their brilliance at the moment where they're looking into the precipice of doom.
Yes.
And so to that perspective, it's really powerful. But actually, it's drawing heavily on a lot of those kind of coaching conversations. It draws from other sort of methods around psychotherapy and other areas, but it's very powerful. I think what I love about coaching is it can be, you haven't got to be in a conflict. I mean, you're going to be going, there's going to be some sort of a change or transition in your life, whatever that might be, that you're trying to come to terms with. There are so many different factors, but it can be triggered by anything, from a serious problem in our organizations or some form of crisis to I want to be brilliant. I want to be the best version of me, and I just want to be able to work with a coach to do that, and everything in between. Whereas mediation is more narrow than that. So the skills, I think, and the qualities are very similar. But in order to get into the mediation, you have to have this thing called conflict, which I would argue we have to be a lot better at dealing with.
Yeah.
I think coaching is more expansive, but they're very much part of a continuum of person-centered approaches, as I understand.
And we talk about, you know, the magic happening. You know, I talk about a kind of whole spectrum of coaching capability, being exec coaches that, you know, got an absolute place for them. But for me, one of the very reasons of starting coaching culture was that I felt it was criminal that the only people who were experiencing coaching conversations in an organization were the exec. It was like some sort of luxury gift, a luxury item reserved for a few. And it was like, no, this is really powerful conversations that everybody should have access to. And that's where coaching culture came from. And you know, leaders and managers having the ability to have some level of coaching conversations to really, you know, show empathy, build the rapport, all the things we've talked about, and building trust and driving performance and just being human-centered again. And all of that, for me, the magic happens in that huge chunk, you know, of the leaders and managers who are making the difference to people's lives every single day. And yeah, that's feels like we're on the same journey here. We're on the same mission together, David, in terms of changing the world of organisations to make them a whole better place.
And what a wonderful place to be as well, Jo. You know, I completely agree with you. And it's, you know, the nice thing is, I mean, you kind of have a lot of conversations and it's taken many, many years, but it is changing. And it's changing at pace now. And it's just great to see organizations starting to embrace this and take the courage and perhaps just ditching some of the old systems, going back to retribution. Retribution is the antithesis of everything that we're trying to do in terms of coaching, dialogue, transformation. Retribution creates fear, betrayal, stress, anxiety. It's fingers pointing, lots of tutting. There's lots of blaming. There's lots of judgment. There's lots of fear. There's lots of hurt. Retribution, retributive justice, delivers no positive outcomes unless you're a lawyer and you're going into litigation, in which there probably are some positive outcomes to be had. But most organizations are about trying to find constructive remedies for their people, not underpin the balance sheet of the local law firm. And I think that, to me, it requires a rethink of what is the purpose of our organization. The purpose of our organization is our people. Put people first and build upwards from there, not building in retribution as a tool for risk mitigation. So that's my message.
Fabulous. One of the guests on our podcast was Casper Craven. He's got a book called Be More Human, and he sent me a big giant mug afterwards, and on it says, put people first and the results will follow. And I literally have that in the office, because it's that, isn't it? Put people first and the results will follow. And I've got it on a giant mug, and it's everything we're talking about. Thankfully,
absolutely right.
More and more people are waking up to that, which is brilliant. So if there was just one, after people listening to this, you've said so many fabulous things and so much learnings in this one podcast. If there was just one piece of advice you would give to organizations, whether that's somebody at the very top of the organization or within HR, what would you be saying to them now to go and start thinking about making this difference?
I mean, I wish I could come up with something really fancy and wonderfully glossy to give to that person that looks wonderful on a meme or on an infographic and stuff. But I can't get beyond listening. I can't, Joe. It kind of feels to me that we need to listen, really listen to hear, to listen to understand. And I feel that there's so many things that get in the way of that. So step up off your chair, turn the computer off, and go for a walk. I mean, it used to be called management by walking about in the olden days when I was doing my MBA in the 90s, but it's had many different names. But go and walk and listen. And it feels basic, and I feel like I'm letting the side down by not giving some really wonderfully glossy answer to this question. But to me, people are desperate to be heard. And when they're heard, they shine. And when they shine, you understand what's going on in your organization. And at the start of that has to be listening. And I'm not listening. It's not, you're not listening for a reason. You're not listening to try and defend the indefensible or to put your case. We're not listening to that first 10% of what they're saying. Then we watch their lips move while we're preparing our argument for the other 90%. We miss all that wonderful stuff. We're really listening to really hear, to understand, to draw insight. We're refraining from judging. We're parking all of those prejudices and those views that we might have of the world. We put that to one side and we really immerse ourselves in what the other person's saying. And it's the best thing you could ever do to another human being is to really hear what they've got to say. It's liberating for you, the listener, actually. I mean, people sometimes are surprised to see this, is just how wonderful the experience is of listening to another person. And when it's done in a way where it's transformational, i.e. the other person then listens to you too. Now we've got dialogue, and dialogue is giving them primacy in our workplaces. And dialogue needs primacy in our workplaces because it's pushed out and designed out. So my simple advice, put as simply as I can, is really listen and really hear what people have got to say.
I love that. Absolutely love that. So I've heard it called recently, listening with intent. So really listen intently.
Yeah.
This is when in coaching, I imagine my ears are the size of an elephant. Otherwise, this can sometimes get in the way. So I have to imagine that I've got Dumbo ears, literally the size of an elephant. And then, so I think if I was going to summarize what you've just said, it's give your employees and your organization a jolly good listening to, which is the phrase that I am going to remember. That is absolutely fantastic. David, is there anything else you'd like to share today that you think our listeners would love to hear from you?
Yeah, there's one process that I have always been inspired by, is a process called nonviolent communication, Joe. Some of your listeners will have heard of it, no doubt. Yeah. And they'll be familiar with Marshall Rosenberg. And actually, it was when you talk about the big ears that that he kind of brought it to mind. And Marshall Rosenberg, you know, he's unfortunately passed away now, but his work lives on of nonviolent communication, NVC. And anyone who's listened to Marshall Rosenberg knows he used to use these puppets. He used to get his guitar out. He was a great, 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 great orator. Used to be an international diplomat and went around the world spreading the messages of peace and nonviolence. And he used to get his giraffe out, and the giraffe didn't listen, didn't understand other people's needs. Was very much around blame and punishment, and the jackal and the giraffe had a little neck, and it listened and it engaged with empathy. And so for me, the nonviolent communication, the ability to observe what's happening around us in an objective way without feeling judged or triggered, to understand how I feel and how others feel, to really connect with people around our feelings, to understand my needs and your needs, and then see how we can build an agreement and a framework around our needs. And rather than making demands on each other in this very demanding world that we live in, and demands that we see placed on each other, we begin to make requests and ask questions. And so that observations and feelings, needs and requests, which Marshall Rosenberg put far more eloquently than I in such a powerful way, has driven me as a restorative practitioner and a mediator. And interestingly, I see my work as in NVC, working across whole organizational change. Interesting. I'm sure if I could, Marshall was still with us, I'd sit down one night and have a conversation with him about how I'm seeing his work starting to be adopted into our organizations as perhaps more cultural norms, as well as tools to promote and advocate these conversations. So I just wanted to share that because it's been something that's been inspiring to me, but it's also something I use practically every day in my work, in whether it's around culture change or conflict resolution.
Oh, this is fantastic. David, you've been an absolute pleasure to speak to. I've loved our conversation. Like I said to you earlier, I thought we could talk forever, and I probably could have definitely talked forever. Thank you so much. And how would you like listeners to get in contact with you? Obviously, I want them all to go out and buy your books. Certainly my transformational culture that's in front of me right here, that's got to be a plug from me to everybody. But how can they contact you? What would be the best way?
Oh, that's Thank you, Joe. Oh, that's really kind of you. So my website, we've got various websites at TCM, but the main website is thetcmgroup.com. So that's www.thetcmgroup.com. You can track me down on LinkedIn, obviously. Please do feel free to connect. And I love having conversations on LinkedIn when I can find the time, but I must make more time. And my email address, Joe, is david.little@thetcmgroup.com. Remember to put the word "the" in, because TCM Group without the is a debt management company, and that ain't us. So it's thetcmgroup.com, the mediation conflict resolution company, not the ones who go chasing people for debt. So thetcmgroup.com, and that's us.
Oh, that's fantastic, David. Thank you so much. So if people want to contact you for their cultural change and managing conflict and not debt management, thetcmgroup.com is the place to go. Thank you, David.
Yes, it is.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed the conversation. And thank you for everything that you do at Coaching Culture. It's a real inspiration, Joe. Thank you so much.
Thank you, David. That's lovely. Thank you.